I blinked at her. You ran off a vampire by yourself? She flashed me a smile that mixed weariness with a sense of pleasure. She still hadn't taken her hand from mine. I've been working out. I looked around a bit more and tried to reach out with my senses to detect any trace of the unsettling energy that hovered around the Reds. Nothing. Gone now, I reported, but we shouldn't hang around out here.
Inside, then?
I started to agree and then paused. A horrible suspicion hit me. I let go of her hand and took a step back. A line appeared between her eyebrows. Harry? It's been a rough year, I said. I want to talk, but I'm not inviting you in. Susan's expression flickered with comprehension and pain. She folded her arms over her stomach and nodded. No, I understand, and you're right to be careful. I took another step back and started walking toward my reinforced steel door. She walked a few feet away and at my side, where I could see her. I went down the stairs and unlocked the door. Then I pushed out an effort of will to temporarily disable the protective spells laid over my house that amounted to the magical equivalent of a landmine and burglar alarm all in one. I went in, glanced at the candle holder on the wall by the door, and muttered, "Flickumbicus." I felt a tiny surge of energy flowing out of me, and the candle danced to life, lighting my apartment in dim, soft orange. My place is basically a cave with two chambers. The larger one was my living area. Bookshelves lined most of the walls, and where they didn't, I had hung a couple of tapestries and an original Star Wars movie poster. I'd scattered rugs all over my floor. I had laid down everything from handmade Navajo rugs to a black area rug with Elvis's face, fully 2 feet across, dominating the piece. Like the beetle, I figured some people would call my ragtag assembly of floor coverings eclectic. I just thought of them as something to walk on, besides freezing cold stone floor. My furniture is much the same. I got most of it second hand. None of it matches, but it's all comfortable to sprawl on, and my lights are dim enough to let me ignore it. A small alcove held a sink, an icebox, and a pantry for food. A fireplace rested against one wall. The wood all burned down to black and gray, but I knew it would still be glowing under the ash. A door led to my tiny bedroom and the apartment's three-quarters bath. The whole place may have been ragged, but it was very tidy and clean. I turned to face Susan and didn't put down my blasting rod. Supernatural creatures cannot lightly step across the threshold of a home unless one of the rightful residents invites them in. Plenty of nasties can put on a false face, and it wasn't inconceivable that one of them had decided to try to get close to me by pretending to be Susan. A supernatural being would have a hell of a time getting over a threshold without being invited in. If that was some kind of shapeshifter rather than Susan, or, God help me, if Susan had gone all the way over to the vampires, she wouldn't be able to enter. If it was the real Susan, she'd be fine. Or at least the threshold wouldn't hurt her. Getting paranoid suspicion from her ex-boyfriend might do its own kind of damage. On the other hand, there was a war on, and Susan probably wouldn't be happy to hear I'd gotten myself killed. Better safe than exsanguinated. Susan didn't pause at the door. She stepped inside, turned around to close and lock it, and asked, "Good enough?" It was. Relief, coupled with a sudden explosion of naked emotion, roared through me. It was like waking up after days of anguish to find that the pain was gone. Where there had been only hurt, there was suddenly nothing, and other feelings rushed in to fill the sudden void. Excitement, for one. That quivering teenage nervousness that accompanies expectation. A surge of warm emotion, joy and happiness rolled together with a chittering glee. And in the shadows of those, a few things darker, but no less vibrant. Sheer sensual pleasure in the scent of her, in looking at her face, her dark hair again. I needed to feel her skin under my hands, to feel her pressed to me. It was more than mere need. It was hunger. Now that she was standing there in front of me, I needed her, all of her, as much as I needed food or water or air. And possibly more. I wanted to tell her, to let her know what it meant to me that she was there. But I'd never been very good at expressing myself verbally. By the time Susan turned around again, I was already pressed up against her. She let out a quiet gasp of surprise, but I leaned gently into her, pressing her shoulders to the door. I lowered my mouth to hers, and her lips were soft, sweet, fever-hot. She went rigid for a second, then let out a low sound and wound her arms around my neck and shoulders, kissing me back. I could feel her, the slender, too warm strength and softness of her body. My hunger deepened, and so did the kiss, my tongue touching hers, lightly teasing. She responded as ardently as I did, her lips almost desperate, low whimpers vibrating through her mouth and into mine. I started to feel a little dizzy and disoriented, and though some part of me warned against it, I only pressed harder against her. I slid one hand over her hip beneath the jacket and slipped up under the t-shirt she wore to curl around the naked sweetness of her waist. I pulled her hard against me, and she responded, her breath hot and quick, lifting one leg to press against mine, winding around my calf a little, pulling me nearer. I lowered my mouth to her throat, tongue tasting her skin, and she arched against me, bearing more of her skin. I drew a line of kisses up to her ear, gently biting, sending quivering shock waves through her as she shook against me, her throat letting out quiet sounds of deepening need. I found her eager lips again, and her fingers tightened in my hair, drawing me hard against her. My dizziness grew. Some kind of coherent thought did a quick flyby of my forebrain. I struggled to take notice of it, but the kiss made it impossible. Lust and need murdered my reason. A sudden, shrieking hiss startled me, and I jerked back from Susan, looking wildly around. Mister, my bob-tailed, battle-scarred tomcat, had leapt up onto the stones before the fireplace, his luminous green eyes wide and fixed on Susan. Mister weighs about 30 pounds, and 30 pounds of cat can make an absolutely impossible amount of noise. Susan shuddered and pressed her palm against my chest, turning her face away from me. She pushed, something gentle rather than insistent. My lips burned to touch hers again, but I closed my eyes and took slow, shuddering breaths. Then I backed away from her. I had meant to go stir up the fire, not that fire, the literal one. But the room tilted wildly, and it was all I could do to stumble into an easy chair. Mister leapt up into my lap, more daintily than he had any right to be able to do, and rubbed his face against my chest, rumbling out a purr. I fumbled up one hand to pet him, and after a couple of minutes the room stopped spinning. "What the hell just happened?" I muttered. Susan emerged from the shadows and crossed the candlelit room to take up the fireplace poker. She stirred through the ashes until she found some glowing orange-red, and then began adding wood to the fire from the old iron hod beside the fireplace. "I could feel you," she said after a minute. "I could feel you going under. It..." She shivered. "It felt nice." Boy, did it. And I bet it would feel even nicer if all those clothes hadn't been in the way. Aloud, all I said was, "Under?" She looked over her shoulder at me, her expression hard to read. "The venom," she said quietly. "They call it their kiss." "I guess I can't blame them. It sounds a lot more romantic than narcotic drool." Some parts of me lobbied for a cessation of meaningless chat and an immediate resumption of any line of thought that would lead to discarded clothing upon the floor. I ignored them. "I remember. When we kissed before you left. I thought I'd imagined it." Susan shook her head and sat down on the stones before the fireplace, her back straight, her hands folded sedately in her lap. The fire began to grow, catching on to the new wood, and though the light of it curled around her with golden fingers, it left her face veiled in shadow. "No. What Bianca did to me has changed me already, in some ways. Physically, I'm stronger now. My senses are sharper. And there's..." She faltered. "The kiss," I mumbled. My lips didn't find the word to their liking. They liked the real thing a lot better. I ignored them, too.
Yes, she said. Not like one of them can do. Less, but still there.
I mopped at my face with my hand. You know what I need? Either a naked, writhing, eager Susan or else a liquid nitrogen shower. A beer. You want one?
Pass, she said. I don't think lowering my inhibitions would be healthy right now.
I nodded, got up, and went to my icebox. It's an actual icebox, the kind that runs on honest-to-goodness ice rather than Freon. I got out a dark brown bottle of Mac's home-brewed ale and opened it, taking a long drink. Mac would have been horrified that I drank his beer cold, since he prided himself on an old-world brew, but I always kept a couple in there for when I wanted it cold. What can I say? I'm an unlettered, barbaric American wizard. I drank off maybe half of it and put the cold bottle against my forehead afterward.
Well, I said, I guess you didn't come over to, tear your clothes off and use you shamelessly, Susan suggested. Her voice sounded calm again, but I could sense the underlying tone of her own hunger. I wasn't sure whether I should be unsettled by it or encouraged.
No, Harry, it isn't. That isn't something I can afford to do with you, no matter how much either of us wants it.
Why not? I asked. I knew why not already, but the words jumped from my brain to my mouth before I could stop them. I peered suspiciously at the beer.
I don't want to lose control, Susan said. Not ever. Not with anyone, but especially not with you.
There was a silence in which only the fire made any noise.
Harry, it would kill me to hurt you.
More to the point, I thought, it would probably kill me, too. Think about her instead of yourself, Harry. Get a grip. It's just a kiss. Let it go. I drank the rest of my beer, which wasn't anywhere near as nice as the other things I'd done with my mouth that night. I checked the fridge and asked Susan, Coke? She nodded, looking around. Her gaze hesitated on the fireplace mantel, where I kept the card and three postcards I'd received from her, along with a little gray jewelry box that held the dinky little ring she'd turned down.
Is someone else living here now?
No. I got out a couple of cans and took one over to her. She took it from me without touching my fingers. Why do you ask?
The place looks so nice, she said. And your clothes smell like fabric softener. You never used fabric softener in your life.
Oh, that. You can't tell people about it when fairies are doing your housework or they get ticked off and leave. I sort of have a cleaning service.
I hear you've been too busy to clean up, Susan said.
Just making a living.
Susan smiled. I heard you saved the world from some kind of doom. Is it true?
I fiddled with my drink. Sort of.
Susan laughed.
How do you sort of save the world? I only saved it in a Greenpeace kind of way. If I'd blown it, there might have been a historically bad storm, but I don't think anyone would have noticed the real damage for 30 or 40 years. Climate change takes time.
Sounds scary, Susan said.
I shrugged. Mostly I was just trying to save my own ass. The world was a twofer. Maybe I'm getting cynical. I suspect the only thing I accomplished was to keep the fairies from screwing up the place so that we could screw it up ourselves. I sat down on the chair again, and we opened the Cokes and drank in silence for a bit. My heart eventually stopped pounding quite so loudly.
I miss you, I said finally.
So does your editor. She called me a couple of weeks ago, said your articles had quit coming in.
Susan nodded. That's one reason I'm here. I owe her more than a letter or a phone call.
You're quitting? I asked. She nodded. You find something else?
Sort of, she said. She brushed her hair back from her face with one hand. I can't tell you everything right now.
I frowned. For as long as I'd known her, Susan had been driven by a passion for discovering the truth and sharing it with other people. Her work at the Arcane had arisen from her stubborn refusal to deny things she saw as the truth, even if they had seemed insane. She was one of the rare people who stopped and thought about things, even weird and supernatural things, instead of dismissing them out of hand. That's how she'd begun to work at the Arcane. That was how she'd originally met me. Are you all right? I asked. Are you in trouble?
Relatively speaking, no, she said. But you are. That's why I'm here, Harry.
What do you mean?
I came to warn you. The Red Court
sent Paolo Ortega to call me out, I know, she sighed.
But you don't know what you're getting into. Harry, Ortega is one of the most dangerous nobles of their court. He's a warlord. He's killed half a dozen of the White Council's wardens in South America since the war started, and he's the one who planned and executed the attack on Archangel last year.
I sat straight up at that, the blood draining from my face. How do you know about that?
I'm an investigative reporter, Harry. I investigated.
I toyed with the Coke can, frowning down at it. All the same, he came here asking for a duel. A fair fight. If he's serious, I'll take him on.
There's more that you need to know, Susan said.
Like what?
Ortega's opinion on the war is not the popular one within the Red Court. A few of the upper crust of the vampires support his way of thinking, but most of them like the idea of a lot of constant bloodshed. They also like the idea of a war to wipe out the White Council. They figure that if they get rid of the wizards once and for all, they won't have to worry about keeping a low profile in the future.
What's that got to do with anything?
Think about it, Susan said. Harry, the White Council is fighting this war reluctantly. If they had a decent excuse, they'd end it. That's Ortega's whole plan. He fights you, kills you, and then the White Council sues for peace. They'll pay some kind of concession that doesn't involve the death of one of their members, and that will be that. War over.
I blinked.
How did you find out? Hello, Earth to Harry. I told you. I investigated.
I frowned until the lines between my eyebrows ached.
Right. Right.
Well, as plans go, I guess it sounds good, I said, except for that middle part where I die. She gave me a small smile.
Much of the rest of the Red Court would rather you kept on breathing. As long as you're alive, they have a reason to keep the war going.
Swell, I said.
They'll try to interfere with any duel. I just thought you should know.
I nodded.
Thanks, I said. I'll...
Just then, someone knocked firmly at my door. Susan stiffened and rose, poker in hand. I got up a lot more slowly, opened a drawer in the night table beside the chair, and drew out the gun I kept at home, a great big old Dirty Harry Callahan number that weighed about 75,000 pounds. I also took out a length of silk rope about a yard long and draped it over my neck so that I could get it off in a hurry if need be. I took the gun in both hands, pointed it at the floor, drew back the hammer, and asked the door, "Who is it?" There was a moment's silence, and then a calm, male voice asked, "Is Susan Rodriguez there?" I glanced at Susan. She straightened more, her eyes flashing with anger, but she put the poker back in its stand beside the fireplace. Then she motioned to me and said, "Put it away. I know him." I uncocked the revolver, but I didn't put it away as Susan crossed to the door and opened it. The most bland-looking human being I had ever seen stood on the other side. He was maybe 5'9", maybe 175. He had hair of medium brown and eyes of the same ambiguous shade. He wore jeans, a medium-weight brown jacket, and worn tennis shoes. His face was unmemorable, neither appealing nor ugly. He didn't look particularly strong or craven or smart or particularly anything else.
"What are you doing here?" he asked Susan without preamble. His voice was like the rest of him, about as exciting as a W-2.
Susan said,
"I told you I was going to talk to him."
"You could have used the phone," the man pointed out. "There's no point to this."
"Hi," I said in a loud voice and stepped up to my door. I towered over bland man, and I had a great big gun in my hand, even if I did keep it pointed down at the floor. "I'm Harry Dresden." He looked me up and down, and then looked at Susan. Susan sighed.
"Harry, this is Martin."
"Hi, Martin," I said. I switched my sidearm to my other hand and thrust mine at him. "Nice to meet you." Martin regarded my hand and then said,
"I don't shake hands." That was evidently all the verbal interaction I merited, because he looked back at Susan and said, "We have to be up early."
"We?
We?" I looked at Susan, who flushed with embarrassment. She glared at Martin and then said to me, "I need to go, Harry. I wish I could have stayed longer."
"Wait," I said.
"I wish I could," she said. "I'll try to call you before we go." There was that "we" again.
"Go? Susan, I'm sorry."
She stood up on tiptoe and kissed my cheek, her two warm lips soft. Then she left, brushing past Martin just hard enough to jostle him into taking a little step to keep his balance. Martin nodded to me and walked out too. After a minute, I followed them, long enough to see them getting into a cab on the street outside.
"We." "Hell's bells," I muttered and stalked back inside my house.
I slammed the door behind me, lit a candle, stomped into my little bathroom, and turned on the shower. The water was only a couple degrees short of becoming sleet, but I stripped and got in anyway, simmering with several varieties of frustration.
"We. We, we, we."
Which implied she and someone else together. Someone who was not me.
Was she?
Susan with the pedantic Avenger there? That didn't track. I mean, hell's bells. The guy was just so dull, boring, blasé, and maybe stable. Face it, Harry. Interesting you might be. Exciting you might be. Stable, you ain't. I pushed my head under the freezing water and left it there. Susan hadn't said they were together. Neither had he. I mean, that wouldn't be why she had broken off the kiss. She had a really good reason to do that, after all. But then again, it wasn't like we were together. She'd been gone for better than a year. A lot can change in a year. Her mouth hadn't, or her hands, or the curve of her body, or the smoldering sensuality of her eyes, or the soft sounds she made as she arched against me, her body begging me to. I looked down at myself, sighed, and turned the water to its coldest setting. I came out of the shower shriveled and turning blue, dried off, and got into bed. I had just managed to get the covers warm so that I could stop shivering when my phone rang. I swore sulphurously, got out of bed into the freezing air, snatched up the phone, and growled, "What?" Then, on the off chance it was Susan, I forced some calm into my voice and said, "I mean, hello?" "Sorry to wake you, Harry," said Karen Murphy, the head of Chicago PD's Special Investigations Division. SI routinely handled any crime that fell between the cracks of the other departments, as well as being handed the really smelly cases no one else wanted. As a result, they wound up looking into all kinds of things that weren't easily explained. Their job was to make sure that things were taken care of, and that everything typed up neatly into the final report. Murphy called me in as a consultant from time to time when she had something weird that she didn't know how to handle. We'd been working together for a while, and Murphy had gotten to where she and SI could handle your average everyday supernatural riffraff. But from time to time, she ran into something that stumped her. My phone number is on her quick dial.
"Murph," I said, "what's up?"
"Unofficial business," she said. "I'd like your take on something."
"Unofficial means not paid, I guess," I said.
"You up for any pro bono work?" She paused and then said, "This could be important to me."
What the hell? My night had pretty much been shot anyway. "Where do you want me?"
"Cook County Morgue," Murphy said. "I want to show you a corpse."
Chapter 5. They don't make morgues with windows. In fact, if the geography allows for it, they hardly ever make morgues above the ground. I guess it's partly because it's easier to refrigerate a bunch of coffin-sized chambers in a room insulated by the earth. But that can't be all there is to it. Under the earth means a lot more than relative altitude. It's where dead things fit. Graves are under the earth. So are Hell, Gehenna, Hades, and a dozen other reported afterlives. Maybe it says something about people.
Maybe for us, under the earth is a subtle and profound statement. Maybe ground level provides us with a kind of symbolic boundary marker, an artificial construct that helps us to remember that we are alive. Maybe it helps us push death's shadow back from our lives. I live in a basement apartment and like it. What does that say about me? Probably that I overanalyze things.
You look pensive, Murphy said.
We walked down an empty hospital corridor toward the Cook County morgue. We'd had to go the long way around so that I could avoid any areas with important medical equipment. My leather duster whispered around my legs as I walked. My blasting rod thumped against my leg rhythmically, where I'd tied it to the inside of the duster. I'd traded in my slacks for blue jeans and my dress shoes for hiking boots. Murphy didn't look like a monster-hunting Valkyrie. Murphy looked like someone's kid sister. She was 5'0", 100-0, and was built like an athlete, all springy muscle. Her blonde hair hung down over her blue eyes and was cut close in back. She wore nicer clothes than usual, a maroon blouse with a gray pantsuit, and she had on more makeup than was her habit. She looked every inch the professional businesswoman. That said, Murphy was a monster-hunting Valkyrie. She was the only person I'd ever heard of who had killed one with a chainsaw.
"I said you look pensive, Harry," she repeated, a little louder.
I shook my head and told Murphy, "I don't like hospitals." She nodded. "Morgues spook me. Morgues and dogs."
"Dogs?" I asked.
"Not like beagles or cocker spaniels or anything. Just big dogs." I nodded. "I like dogs. They give Mister something to snack on." Murphy gave me a smile. "I've seen you spooked. It doesn't make you look like that." "What do I look like?" I asked.
Murphy pursed her lips as though considering her words.
"You look worried and frustrated and guilty. You know, romance things."
I gave her a wry glance and then nodded. "Susan's in town."
Murphy whistled.
"Wow. She's okay?"
"Yeah, as much as she can be."
"Then why do you look like you just swallowed something that was still wriggling?"
I shrugged. "She's in town to quit her job, and she was with someone."
"A guy?" Murphy asked.
"Yeah."
She frowned. "With him or with him?"
I shook my head.
"Just with him, I think. I don't know." "She's quitting her job?"
"Guess so. We're gonna talk, I think."
"She said so?"
"Said she'd get in touch and we'd talk."
Murphy's eyes narrowed and she said,
"Ah, one of those."
"Huh?" I said and eyed her. She lifted her hands, palms out. "None of my business."
"Hell's bells, Murph."
She sighed and didn't look up at me and didn't speak for a few steps. Finally, she said,
"You don't set up a guy for a good talk, Harry."
I stared at her profile and then scowled down at my feet for a while. No one said anything. We got to the morgue. Murphy pushed a button on the wall and said, "It's Murphy," at a speaker next to the door. A second later, the door buzzed and clicked. I swung open the door and held it for Murphy. She gave me an even look before she went through. Murphy does not respond well to chivalry. The morgue was like others I'd seen, cold, clean, and brightly lit with fluorescent lights. Metal refrigerator doors lined one wall. An occupied autopsy table sat in the middle of the room, and a white sheet covered its subject. A rolling medical cart sat next to the autopsy table, another by a cheap office furniture desk. Polka music, heavy on accordion and clarinet, oompahed cheerfully through the room from a little stereo on the desk. At the desk sat a small man with a wild shock of black hair. He was dressed in medical scrubs and green bunny slippers, complete with floppy ears. He had a pen clenched in one hand and scribbled furiously at a stack of forms. When we came in, he held up a hand toward us and finished his scribbling with a flourish before hopping up with a broad smile.
"Karen," he said. "Wow, you're looking nice tonight. What's the occasion?"
"Municipal brass are tromping around," Murphy said, "so we're all supposed to wear our Sunday clothes and smile a lot." Bastards, the little guy said cheerfully. He shot me a glance. You aren't supposed to be spending money on psychic consultants either, I bet. You must be Harry Dresden.
That's what it says on my underwear, I agreed.
He grinned. Great coat. Love it.
Harry, Murphy said, this is Waldo Butters, assistant medical examiner. Butters shook my hand, then turned to walk to the autopsy table. He snapped on some rubber gloves and a surgical mask.
Pleased to meet you, Mr. Dresden, he said over his shoulder. Seems like every time you're working with SI, my job gets really interesting.
Murphy chucked me on the arm with one fist and followed Butters. I followed her.
Masks on that tray to your left. Stay a couple of feet back from the table, and for God's sake, don't throw up on my floor.
We put on masks, and Butters threw back the sheet. I'd seen corpses before. Hell's bells, I'd created some. I'd seen what was left of people who had been burned alive, savaged to death by animals, and who had died when their hearts exploded out of their chests, courtesy of black magic. But I hadn't ever seen anything quite like this. I shoved the thought to the back of my head and tried to focus purely upon taking in details. It wouldn't do to think too much, looking at this. Thinking too much would lead me to messing up Butters's floor. The victim had been a man, maybe a little over 6 feet tall, thin build. His chest looked like 20 pounds of raw hamburger. Fine grid marks stretched vertically from his collarbones to his belly and horizontally across the width of his body. The cuts were spaced maybe a 1/16 of an inch apart, and the grid pattern slashed into the flesh looked nearly flawless. The cuts were deep ones, and I had the unsettling impression that I could have brushed my hand across the surface of that ruined body and sent chunks of flesh pattering to the floor. The Y incision of the autopsy had been closed, at least. Its lines marred the precision of the grid of incisions. The next thing I noticed were the corpse's arms, or rather, the missing bits of them. His left arm had been hacked off 2 or 3 inches above the wrist. The flesh around it gaped, and a shard of black crusted bone poked out from it. His right arm had been severed just beneath the elbow, with similar hideous results. My belly twitched, and I found myself taking one of those pre-vomit breaths. I closed my eyes for a second and forced the impending reaction down. Don't think, Harry. Look. See what there is to see. That isn't a man anymore. It's just a shell. Throwing up won't bring him back. I opened my eyes again, tore my gaze from his mutilated chest and hands, and forced myself to study the corpse's features. I couldn't. His head had been hacked off, too. I stared at the ragged stump of his neck. The head just wasn't there, even though that's where heads go. Ditto his hands. A man should have a head, should have hands. They shouldn't simply be gone. The impression it left on me was unsettling, simply and profoundly wrong. Inside me, some little voice started screaming and running away. I stared down at the corpse, my stomach threatening insurrection again. I stared at his missing head, but aloud, all I said was, "Gee, wonder what killed him." "What didn't kill him?" Butters said. "I can tell you this much, it wasn't blood loss." I frowned at Butters. "What do you mean?" Butters lifted one of the corpse's arms and pointed down at dark mottling in the dead gray flesh, just where the corpse's back met the table. "See that?" he asked. "Lividity. If this guy bled out from his wrists or his neck, either one, I don't think there'd be enough blood left in the body to show this much. His heart would have just kept on pumping it out of his body until he died." I grunted.
"If not one of the wounds, then what was it?"
"My guess," Butters said. "Plague." I blinked and looked at him.
"Plague," he said again. "Or more accurately, plagues. His insides looked like models for a textbook on infection. Not all the tests have come back yet, but so far every one I've done has returned positive. Everything from bubonic plague to strep throat. And there are symptoms I've found in him that don't match any disease I've ever heard of."
"You're telling me he died of disease?" I asked.
"Diseases, plural. And get this. I think one of them was smallpox. I thought smallpox was extinct, Murphy said. Pretty much. They have some in vaults, probably some in some bioweapon research facilities, but that's it.
I stared at Butters for a second. And we're standing here next to his plague-ridden body, why?
Relax, Butters said. The really nasty stuff wasn't airborne. I disinfected the corpse pretty well. Wear your mask and don't touch it. You should be fine.
What about the smallpox? I said. Butters' voice turned wry.
You're vaccinated.
This is dangerous, though, isn't it? Having the body out like this.
Yeah, Butters said, his voice frank. But county is full, and the only thing that's going to happen if I report an occurrence of free-range smallpox is another evaluation.
Murphy shot me a warning look and stepped a very little bit between me and Butters.
You got a time of death?
Butters shrugged.
Maybe 48 hours ago, tops. All of those diseases seem to sprout up at exactly the same time. I make cause of death as either shock or a massive failure and necrosis of several major organs, plus tissue damage from an outrageously high fever. It's anyone's guess as to which one gets the blue ribbon. Lungs, kidneys, heart, liver, spleen.
We get the point, Murphy said.
Let me finish. It's like every disease the guy had ever had contact with all got together and planned when to hit him. It just isn't possible. He probably had more germs in him than blood cells.
I frowned. And then someone ginsued him after he died? Butters nodded.
Partly, though the cuts on his chest weren't post-mortem. They'd filled with blood. Tortured before he died, maybe.
Ugh, I said. Why?
Murphy regarded the corpse without any emotion showing in her cool blue eyes. Whoever cut him up must have taken the arms and hands to make it hard to identify him after he died. That's the only logical reason I can think of.
Same here, said Butters.
I frowned down at the table.
Why prevent identification of the corpse if it had died of disease?
Butters began to lower the arm slowly, and I saw something as he did.
Wait. Hold it.
He looked up at me. I pressed closer to the table and had Butters lift the arm again. I had almost missed it against the rotted tone of the dead man's flesh. A tattoo, maybe an inch square, located on the inside of the corpse's biceps. It wasn't fancy. Faded green ink in the shape of a symbolic open eye, not too different from the CBS Network logo.
See there? I asked.
Murphy and Butters peered at the tattoo.
Do you recognize it, Harry?
Murphy asked. I shook my head. Almost looks old Egyptian, but with fewer lines.
Hey, Butters, do you have a piece of paper?
Better, Butters said. He got an old instant camera off the bottom tray of one of the medical carts and snapped several shots of the tattoo. He passed one of them over to Murphy, who waved it around a little while the image developed. I got another.
Okay, I said, thinking out loud. Guy dies of a zillion diseases he somehow contracted all at once. How long do you think it took?
Butters shrugged.
No idea. I mean, the odds against him getting all of those at once like that are beyond astronomical.
Days?
I asked. If I had to guess, Butters said, I'd say more like hours, maybe less.
Okay, I said. And during those hours, someone uses a knife on him and turns his chest into tuna cubes. Then when they're done, they take his hands and his head and dump the body.
Where was it found?
Under an overpass on the expressway, Murphy said. Like this, naked.
I shook my head.
S.I. got handed this one?
Murphy's face flickered with annoyance.
Yep. Homicide dumped it on us to take some high-profile case all the municipal folk are hot about.
I took a step back from the corpse, frowning, putting things together. I figured odds were pretty good that there weren't all that many people running around the world torturing victims by carving their skin into graph paper before murdering them. At least I hoped there weren't all that many.
Murphy peered at me, her expression serious.
What? Harry, do you know something?
I glanced from Murphy to Butters and then back again. Butters raised both his hands and headed for the doors, stripping his gloves and dumping them in a container splattered with red biohazard signs.
"You guys stay here and molder it out. I have to go down the hall anyway. Back in 5 minutes."
I watched him go and said, after the door swung shut,
"Bunny slippers and polka music."
"Don't knock it," Murphy said. "He's good at his job. Maybe too good."
"What does that mean?" She walked away from the autopsy table, and I followed her. Murphy said,
"Butters was the one who handled the bodies after the fire at the Velvet Room."
"The one I'd started."
"Oh?"
"Mm-hmm.
His original report stated that some of the remains recovered from the scene were humanoid, but definitely not human."
"Yeah," I said, "red vampires."
Murphy nodded.
"But you can't just stick that in a report without people getting their panties in a bunch."
Butters wound up doing a 3-month stint at a mental hospital for observation.
When he came out, they tried to fire him, but his lawyer convinced them that they couldn't. So instead, he lost all his seniority and got stuck on the night shift. But he knows there's weirdness out there. He calls me when he gets some of it.
Seems nice enough, except for the polka.
Murphy smiled again and said,
"What do you know?"
"Nothing I can tell you," I said. "I agreed to keep the information confidential." Murphy peered up at me for a moment. Once upon a time, that comment might have sent her into a fit of stubborn confrontation, but I guess times had changed.
"All right," she said. "Are you holding back anything that might get someone hurt?"
I shook my head.
"It's too early to tell."
Murphy nodded, her lips pressed together. She appeared to weigh things for a moment before saying,
"You know what you're doing."
"Thanks." She shrugged.
"I expect you to tell me if it turns into something I should know."
"Okay," I said, staring at her profile. Murphy had done something I knew she didn't do very often. She'd extended her trust. I'd expected her to threaten and demand. I could have handled that. This was almost worse. Guilt gnawed on my insides. I'd agreed not to divulge anything, but I hated doing that to Murphy. She'd gone out on a limb for me too many times. But what if I didn't tell her anything? What if I just pointed her toward information she'd find sooner or later in any case? "Look, Murph, I specifically agreed to confidentiality for this client. But if I were going to talk to you, I'd tell you to check out the murder of a Frenchman named LaRoche with Interpol." Murphy blinked and then looked up at me.
"Interpol?"
I nodded. "If I were going to talk."
"Right," she said.
"If you'd said anything, you tight-lipped bastard." One corner of my mouth tugged up into a grin. "Meanwhile, I'll see if I can't find out anything about that tattoo." She nodded.
"You figure we're dealing with another sorcerer type?"
I shrugged.
"Maybe. But if you give someone a disease with magic, it's usually so that you make it look like they haven't been murdered. Natural causes. This kind of mishmash. I don't know. Maybe it's something a demon would do."
"A real demon? Like exorcist demon?" I shook my head.
"Those are the fallen, the former angels. Not the same thing."
"Why not?"
"Demons are just intelligent beings from somewhere in the never-never. Mostly, they don't care about the mortal world, if they notice it at all. The ones who do are usually the hungry types, or the mean types that someone calls up to do thug work, like that thing Leonid Kravos had called up."
Murphy shivered.
"I remember. And the fallen?"
"They're very interested in our world, but they aren't free to act like demons are."
"Why not?"
I shrugged.
"Depends on who you talk to. I've heard everything from advanced magical resonance theory to because God said so. One of the fallen couldn't do this unless it had permission to."
"Right. And how many people would give permission to be infected and then tortured to death?" Murphy said.
"Yeah, exactly."
She shook her head.
"Going to be a busy week. Half a dozen professional hitters for the outfit are in town. The county morgue is doing double business. City Hall is telling us to bend over backward for some bigwig from Europe or somewhere. And now some kind of plague monster is leaving unidentifiable mutilated corpses on the side of the road."
That's why they pay you the big bucks, Murph.
Murphy snorted. Butters came back in, and I made my goodbyes. My eyes were getting heavy, and I had aches in places where I hadn't known I had places. Sleep sounded like a great idea, and with so many things going on, the smart option was to get lots of rest in order to be as capably paranoid as possible. I walked the long route back out of the hospital, but found the hall blocked by a patient on some kind of life support machinery being moved on a gurney from one room to another. I wound up heading out through the empty cafeteria into an alley not far from the emergency room exit. A cold chill started at the base of my spine and slithered up over my neck. I stopped and looked around me, reaching for my blasting rod. I extended my magical senses as best I could, tasting the air to see what had given me the shivers. I found nothing, and the eerie sensation eased away. I started down the alley toward a parking garage half a block from the hospital and tried to look in every direction at once as I went. I passed a little old homeless man hobbling along heavily on a thick wooden cane. A while farther on, I passed a tall, young black man dressed in an old overcoat and tattered and too small suit, clutching an open bottle of vodka in one heavy-knuckled hand. He glowered at me, and I moved on past him. Chicago nightlife. I kept on moving toward my car and heard footsteps growing closer behind me. I told myself not to be too jumpy. Maybe it was just some other frightened, endangered, paranoid, sleep-deprived consultant who had been called to the morgue in the middle of the night. Okay, maybe not. The steady tread of the footsteps behind me shifted, becoming louder and unsteady. I spun to face the person following me, raising the blasting rod in my right hand as I did. I turned around in time to see a bear, a freaking grizzly bear, fall to all 4 feet and charge. I had already begun preparing a magical strike with the rod, and the tip burst into incandescent light. Shadows fell harshly back from the scarlet fire of the rod, and I saw the details of the thing coming at me. It wasn't a bear. Not unless a bear can have 6 legs and a pair of curling ram's horns wrapping around the sides of its head. Not unless bears can somehow get an extra pair of eyes right over the first set, one pair glowing with faint orange light and one with green. Not unless bears have started getting luminous tattoos of swirling runes on their foreheads and started sprouting twin rows of serrated, slime-coated teeth. It came charging toward me, several 100 pounds of angry-looking monster, and I did the only thing any reasonable wizard could have done. I turned around and ran like hell. Chapter 6. I'd learned something in several years of professional wizarding. Never walk into a fight when the bad guys are the ones who set it up. Wizards can call down lightning from the heavens, rip apart the earth beneath their enemies' feet, blow them into a neighboring time zone with gale winds, and a million other things even less pleasant. But not if we don't plan things out in advance. And we're not all that much tougher than regular folks. I mean, if some nasty creature tears my head off my shoulders, I'll die. I might be able to lay out some serious magical pounding when I need to, but I'd made the mistake of tangling with a few things that had prepared to go up against me, and it hadn't been pretty. This bear thing, whatever the hell it was, had followed me. Hence, it had probably picked its time and place. I could have stood and blasted away at it, but in the close quarters of the alley, if it was able to shrug off my blasts, it would tear me apart before I could try Plan B. So I ran. One other thing I'd learned. Wheezy wizards aren't all that good at running. That's why I'd been practicing. I took off at a dead sprint and fairly flew down the alley, my duster flapping behind me. The bear thing snarled as it came after me, and I could hear it slowly gaining ground. The mouth of the alley loomed into sight, and I ran as hard as I could for it. Once I was in the open with room to dodge and put obstacles between me and the creature, I might be able to take a shot at it. The creature evidently realized that because it let out a vicious, spitting growl and then leapt. I heard it gather itself for the leap and turned my head enough to see it out of the corner of my eye. It flew at my back. I threw myself down, sliding and rolling over the asphalt. The creature soared over me to land at the mouth of the alley, a good 20 feet ahead. I skidded to a stop and went running back down the alley, a growing sense of fear and desperation giving my feet a set of chicken yellow wings. I ran for maybe 10 seconds, gritting my teeth as the creature took up the pursuit again. I couldn't keep up a full sprint forever. Unless I thought of something else, I was going to have to turn and take my chances. I all but flattened the tall young black man I'd seen earlier when I leapt over a moldering pile of cardboard boxes. He let out a startled noise, and I answered it with a low curse. "Come on," I said, grabbing his arm. "Move! Move! Move!" He looked past me, and his eyes widened. I looked back and saw the four glowing eyes of the bear creature coming at us. I hauled him into motion, and he picked up speed and started running with me. We ran for a few seconds more before the little old derelict I'd seen earlier came limping along on his cane. He looked up, and the dim light from the distant street glinted on a pair of spectacles. "Ugh!" I shouted. I shoved my running partner past me toward the old man and snarled, "Get him out of here! Both of you, run!" I whirled to face the bear creature and swept my blasting rod to point right at it. I ran some force of will down into the energy channels in the rod, and with a snarled, "Fuego!" sent a lance of raw fire whipping through the air. The blast slammed into the bear creature's chest, and it hunched its shoulders, turning its head to one side. Its forward charge faltered, and it slid to a stop, crashing against a weathered old metal trash can. "What do you know?" I muttered. "It worked." I stepped forward and unleashed another blast at the creature, hoping to either melt it to bits or drive it away. The bear thing snarled and turned a hateful, murderous gaze at me with its four eyes. The soul gaze began almost instantly. When a wizard looks into someone's eyes, he sees more than just what color they are. Eyes are windows to the soul. When I make eye contact for too long or too intently, I get to peek in through the windows. You can't hide what you are from a wizard's soul gaze, and he can't hide from you. You both see each other for what you are within, and it's with a clarity so intense that it burns itself into your head. Looking on someone's soul is something you never forget, no matter how badly you might want to. I felt a whirling, gyrating sensation and fell forward into the bear thing's eyes. The glowing sigil on its forehead became a blaze of silver light the size of a stadium scoreboard set against a roundish cliffside of dark green and black marble. I expected to see something hideous, but I guess you can't judge a monster by the slime on its scales. What I saw instead was a man of lean middle years dressed in rags. His hair was long and straight, wispy gray that fell down to his chest. He stood in a posture of agony, his wiry body stretched out in an arch, with his hands held up and apart, his legs stretched out. I followed the lines of his arms back and up and saw why he stood that way. He'd been crucified. The man's back rested against the cliff, the great glowing sigil stretching out above him. His arms were pulled back in an agonizing angle and were sunk to the elbow in the green-black marble of the cliff. His knees were bent, his feet sunk into the stone as well. He hung there, the pressure of all his weight on his shoulders and legs. It must have been agonizing. The crucified man laughed at me, his eyes glowing a shade of sickly green, and screamed,
"As if it will help you! Nothing! You're nothing!"
Pain laced his voice, making it shrill. Agony contorted the lines of his body, veins standing out sharply against straining muscle.
"Stars and stones," I whispered.
Creatures like this bear thing did not have souls to gaze upon. That meant that regardless of appearances to the contrary, this thing was immortal. It, no, he, was a human being.
"What the hell is this?"
The man screamed again, this time all rage and anguish, void of words. I lifted a hand and stepped forward, my first instinct to help him. Before I got close, the ground began to shake. The cliff face rumbled and slits of seething orange light appeared, and then widened,
until I faced the second set of eyes, eyes the size of subway tunnels opening on the great marble cliff. I stumbled several steps back, and that cliff face proved to be exactly that, a face, cold and beautiful and harsh around that fiery gaze. The quaking in the earth increased, and a voice louder than a Metallica concert spoke. The raw sense of the words, the vicious anger and hate behind them, hitting me far more heavily than mere volume.
Get out!
The sheer force of presence behind that voice seized me and threw me violently back, away from the tortured man at the cliffside and out of the soul gaze. The mental connection snapped like dry spaghetti, and the same force that had thrown my mind away from the soul gaze sent my physical body flying back through the air. I hit an old cardboard box filled with empty bottles and heard glass shattering beneath me. The heavy leather duster held, and no broken shards buried themselves in my back. For a second or two, I just lay on my back, stunned. My thoughts were a hectic whirlpool I couldn't calm or control. I stared up at the city's light pollution against the low clouds until some tiny voice in me started screaming that I was in danger. I shoved myself to my knees just as the bear creature smacked a trash can aside with one of its paws and started toward me. My head was still ringing with the after effects of the soul gaze and the psychic assault that had broken the connection. I lifted my blasting rod, summoned up every bit of will I could scrape together out of the confusion, and spat a word that sent another lance of flame toward the bear creature. This time the blast didn't even slow it down. The set of orange eyes flared with a sudden luminance, and my fire splashed against an unseen barrier, dispersing around the creature in sheets of scarlet. It let out a screaming roar and lumbered toward me. I tried to get up, stumbled, and fell at the feet of the little old homeless guy, who leaned on his cane and stared at the creature. I had a dim impression of his features. Asian, a short white beard around his chin, heavy white eyebrows, and corrective glasses that made his eyes look the size of an owl's.
"Run, damn it!"
I shouted at him. I tried to lead by example, but my balance was still whirling and I couldn't get off the ground. The old man did not turn to run. He took off his glasses and pushed them at me. "Hold, please." Then he took a deliberate step forward with his cane, placing himself between me and the bear creature. The creature hurled itself at him with a bellow, rearing up on its hindmost legs. It plunged down at the white-haired man, jaws gaping, and I couldn't do anything but watch it happen. The little man took two steps to one side, pirouetting like a dancer. The end of his wooden cane lashed out and struck the creature's jaws with a crunching impact. Bits of broken yellow teeth flew from the creature's mouth. The little man continued his turn and evaded its claws by maybe an inch. He wound up behind the creature, and it turned to follow him, huge jaws snapping in rage. The man darted back, staying just ahead of the thing's jaws, and in a blur of sudden light on metal, he drew from his cane a long blade. The classic single-edged, chisel-pointed katana. The steel flashed at the creature's eyes, but it ducked low enough that the scything blade only whipped the top couple of inches from one of its ears. The creature screamed, entirely out of proportion with the injury, a yowl that almost sounded human. It lurched back, shaking its head, a fine spray of blood sprinkling from its wounded ear. At this point, I noticed three things. One, the creature was paying me no attention whatsoever. Yippee-ki-yay. My head still spun wildly, and if it had come for me, I didn't think I could have done anything about it. Two, the old man's sword was not reflecting light. It was emitting it. The water-patterned steel of the blade glowed with a steady silver flame that slowly grew brighter. Three, I could feel the humming power of the sword, even from several yards away. It throbbed with a steady, deep strength, as quiet and unshakable as the earth itself. In my entire life, I'd seen only one sword imbued with that much power. But I knew that there were a couple more.
"Oi!"
shouted the little old man, his English heavily accented.
"Arceo! Let him go! You have no power here!
The bear creature, Urciel, I presumed, focused its four-eyed gaze on the little man and did something unsettling.